This is Wake Up Call.
Another kind of daytime radio program.
On the Sports Map Radio Network.
All right. Let's do this.
Alongside Ron Culver, here's Tony D.
All right, thanks for joining us as we roll along this morning. Good throwback Thursday to you. Really fun this time of year when we can talk Super Bowls and previous Super Bowls. It's one of the things I really enjoy. I'm a semi-Super Bowl historian. I love the game. I love the meaning of the game and its value. And we're going to Las Vegas. We're going to be playing the Super Bowl in Las Vegas, which if you went back maybe 10 years ago, it would have seemed insane. Not yesterday and not 2 years ago, obviously, when the Raiders got there. There has been a change in that city, and its image of the city has been going on for quite a while. I mean, it started with the Vegas Golden Knights getting there, but it really started when there was a universal, a court ruling that allowed states to get involved in gambling, that allowed states to now start allowing its residents to gamble. And that when that opened up the door to my state of Tennessee, maybe your state, allowing you to go online, get an account, put that account in, make some bets on some games or whatnot, it made Vegas, which was sort of that, you know, Sin City sort of nickname, it allowed it to permeate pretty much everywhere you went. And once that happened, and once there was this sort of feeling like, well, maybe what they're doing isn't so bad for sports after all, and everybody can actually make some money off of this and the partnership with these entities that are creating online sports books, then the image of Vegas became more acceptable to the powers that be that run these you know, sports businesses as to getting stuff in Vegas. I was there in 1998, and I left in 2001. So I was there a good part of my young career in the city of Las Vegas. Now, when I moved out to Las Vegas, I mostly went out there to work with the Las Vegas Motor Speedway. I was a young reporter that was working a beat. I was working a motor racing beat in New Hampshire. And when I got really heavily entrenched in that, and I got to know a lot of people, there was this buzz in the early 90s that Las Vegas was building a track. And, you know, you're young. I had grown up in New Hampshire. I was kind of looking for a way to get out of New Hampshire. I was being like, you know, hey, listen, I want to expand my roots. And once people started talking about, hey, there's this track, you might want to get on that. I did. And when I went out there, I was working as a motorsports guy. I was going to call races, smaller races for them. And I was doing all this stuff. But I got to see the city and how much they loved UNLV basketball. And it really was, if you were to ask anybody back then, the three most important teams in the city of Las Vegas, it would be Vegas, you know, running rebels. There was nothing else. Nobody was involved in the minor league stuff. And Lord knows I worked for a couple of those as well. Just, you know, with the minor league basketball, there was a minor league hockey team nobody ever went to. There was a minor league roller skating hockey team nobody went to. There was a minor league baseball team that, yeah, people kind of went, but it's like any other minor league baseball stadium you'd find anywhere else in America. Had its diehards, but pretty much nobody really knew if they were playing or not. And what would happen is every now and then there would be something that would come to Las Vegas as an exhibition. So the NBA might have a preseason game at the Thomas and Mack Center. That's where Kobe and Shaq once were there, and we got to see them. And the Avalanche and Kings might play a hockey game in the MGM arena, hockey arena. And you'd go, okay, this is kind of cool. And then when anybody would ever ask, would this city ever be a sports town? The answer was always no. No, because the money that was generated by the sports books for the again with the teams and the leagues was just too much to turn down. That was always the stipulation, right? So you might have remembered the Maloof brothers. You probably have heard of them. They own the Palms Hotel Casino. They also own the Sacramento Kings at one point, right? And there was all this buzz about the Maloofs are going to move the team to Las Vegas. There was also a rumor that the Clippers might come to Las Vegas as they were trying to forge this, an identity in the Staples Center with the Lakers, and they didn't really have anything, that they might move. But that was always sort of that kind of a rumor. That was never really any facts to it. The Maloof brothers sounded like that would work, that they could move. But David Stern said at the time, if you want to move the team to Las Vegas, you have to get the sports books to agree not to bet on NBA. You can't take action on NBA games. Well, that was just never in a thousand trillion million years ever going to happen.
I think Stern knew that.
Yeah, and Stern knew that, right. So he's like, you're not moving. You don't have to, you can't move to Vegas because I'm going to propose something that is never, ever, ever going to pass, ever. So that was always the sticking point.
And it, Which is now kind of funny to think about when, like, when you look back on it, because we all assumed that if there was a sport that was going to end up in Vegas, would be the NBA.
It would be the NBA. Players like it there.
It
would
be the easiest one to transition because, you know, it's a basketball arena.
That's right. That's right. And even though the Thomas and Mack may not have been NBA ready, it's still a very, very nice arena.
Yeah.
It's rather large. It's not your typical arena that you find on college campuses. It's not your typical, like, Cameron Indoor Stadium, which is actually very, very small, but like the O-Dome in Gainesville or Coleman Coliseum in Tuscaloosa or places like that where you could sense this is a college gym. The Thomas & Mack was a major indoor arena. It was a major, it was used for everything from hockey games, national finals rodeo, you know, UNLV basketball, championship basketball, like conference championship games. It's a very, very nice arena. Concerts. I saw Jeff Foxworthy there on New Year's Eve, 1999. I saw a bunch of other acts there. So it was a major arena. And the NBA could have let that play out until somebody wanted to build a better arena,
right,
or whatnot. But the idea that, again, that this city, and I have a friend, Ron Futrell, who was one of the first people I met there, and he was from Los Angeles. He was a young guy from Los Angeles that got the job and got a TV job in Las Vegas and never left. He's been there for 30, 40 years. He's never left. And he's been there, and it's his home, and that's where he is. He never wanted to leave it. And he knew the deal, just like I knew the deal when I went there. When I knew I wasn't covering pro teams when I got there. I wasn't going to be in an NBA locker room. I wasn't going to be in an NFL game. And I was kind of used to that. Right off the bat, in my station in New Hampshire, I covered Patriots games. I went to Celtics camps. If there was something that my boss wanted to send me to in Boston, I went all the time. I covered press conferences. I went down to the Nancy Kerrigan press conference when she was announcing that she was coming back training for the Olympics right after that. Yeah. It wasn't my finest point because I got there and I didn't know what I was doing.
And
I
asked her why.
I plugged, I wish. I didn't ask any questions. I just found where the malt box was, and I like, let me just plug in, hit record. She spoke, I left. That was basically it. But I was used to sort of being on a level of covering professional sports. I knew when I was going to UNLV, Las Vegas, that was it. I wasn't going to do any of that, right? The only thing I was going to do was NASCAR and Rebels basketball. But he stayed. He followed Jerry Tarkanian. He followed that championship team in 90. He stayed through it all. And now he is watching this city become a place for a Super Bowl, a Final Four down the road. There's going to be a baseball team with the A's moving there. There's going to be an NBA team at some point because I know the NBA is not going to want to be left out of this market now that the NFL is in there. The NHL has won a Stanley Cup there. I mean, you could talk about the WNBA winning back-to-back titles, whatever. But it is now becoming a place where it is acting as if nobody had a problem with this forever and ever and ever, and nothing about the city changed. Nothing about the city changed. What changed was what was going on with everything else in the country. Now, I guarantee you that there has been an owner or two in the last 20 years in the NFL that has gone to the commissioner and said, you know, we'd like a new stadium, and we'd like to consider Las Vegas. And Roger Goodell said, not a chance. But once it was like, hey, look, we're all in on this. Every place in the country now is doing this. There's so much money. Then it became, of course. Of course. And give it to the NHL. The NHL was one of the first ones to crack this. They weren't afraid to go there. They weren't afraid to say, bet on NHL games. We don't think there's anything wrong with that. We got it. We're policing this. We're pretty good. What are you afraid of? And something that people kind of forget is these sports books and the people who run these sports books are fantastic at watching this. They're fantastic at watching trends. They're the first ones to report when they feel like something's wrong,
right,
when they feel like something's off. People sort of forget this. But if you're running a sports book, that's part of your job. Where's the money coming from? Who's putting most of it on what? And why is this game that we have decades of trends on who bets on what games? Why is this one in particular way out of the algorithm?
Yeah, because their other first instinct, we need to keep the money.
Right. Right, and we're trying to get the line so that we get money on both sides. So when you have a game, like let's say you have a Pac-12 basketball game between Washington and Cal, right? And you're like, well, we expect X amount of dollars to be bet based on what our past experience is. We know that there are Pac-12 fans, and so people come in, and they're putting this amount of money, and this is about the range we like to see. And if that's way out of whack, and it's way out of whack for one particular team, they go, that's something wrong. Mark that. Let's monitor that, and let's watch where that's going. That's how they caught the Arizona State scandal. When Arizona State was throwing games, that's how they caught it. They were like, we expect a certain amount of dollars for Arizona State, and we're seeing way more going against them, and we don't think this is right. They started following, and they notified the FBI on it. So it's something a lot of people don't seem to understand how that business works. And so it shouldn't have been scary for David Stern to demand that you don't bet on NBA games. But my thing was, I think David Stern absolutely knew how that business worked. He just didn't want a team in Las Vegas. He just, for all the other reasons that Las Vegas is, I didn't think he wanted the hassle of having a team.
Well, you know, there's probably a part of David too, like knowing players, you know, young players who have money. You know, his main goal was always to protect the brand.
Exactly. And listen, somebody had to be the first. And the NHL dying for something different was more than happy to be the first. But once they became the first, bingo, look where it is now. It's about ready to be a 4-star city. All right, we'll continue. It is Wake Up Call on Sports Map Radio.
Listening to Wake Up Call on the Sports Map Radio Network. Alongside Ron Culver, here's Tony D.
Yeah, we're throwing a little La Vida Loca at you. Is that what this is? Coldplay?
Yep.
Yeah. No, it's not La Vida Loca. That was Ricky.
This is Vida La Vida.
Vida La Vida. That's right. They're all the same to me. Okay. Tomato, tomato. It's a fugazi, a fugazi. It's a fairy dust.
Yeah.
Right?
Is it Vida La Vida? Is that like
live to live? Yeah. I remember this song.
Live the life.
This was. Can I be honest with you? I don't know how to feel about this song. It had a great beat, but I felt like it was kind of cheesy.
You know what it is? It's. I'm letting it play a little extra here, so we can ridicule
rip
it a little bit.
Yeah.
What it is it is unofficially Coldplay's anthem.
Ah, that's a good point. Yeah,
but it felt like it was forced. Like this anthem is forced onto us. Like, guys, they made an anthem. This is their anthem. Listen to their anthem. Instead of letting us go, like, no, this is their signature song. This is the one we always think about.
Right, right.
Like it was,
not clocks.
Remember that? I like Fix You.
I just got a feeling like I like this when it came out, but I'm almost like embarrassed I like it today. It's a it's a weird feeling with this song. Anyway, we got breaking news. The Washington Commanders are now off the board. If you wanted the job, you aren't getting the job. If you were waiting to be an interview to be the head coach of the Washington Commanders, it's done. They have hired Dan Quinn to be their new head coach.
I wonder what happened. I thought he was shoo-in for Seattle.
I did too. I know, right? He was supposed to be Seattle's guy.
Yeah.
So
that just goes to show you there were no slam dunks. I mean, you know, we all thought Belichick to Falcons was a slam dunk. No, Dan Quinn to Seattle. No,
the coaching cycle is done.
Complete.
It's now complete. We started the month with a bunch of them. Some were surprises. Some were filled really quick. But then
did it almost go like
done.
A reverse order?
Yeah,
in a way.
That's right.
Because like the Patriots were the last one to let go of a coach, but the first one to hire one.
Yeah, right. That's right. Exactly. Like that's a great point.
And then wasn't Washington the first one to fire?
Yeah,
Robert.
I think I can't. That's a great point. That's a great point. Who was fired first? Was it Josh McDaniels or Ron Rivera? Was Ron Rivera fired at the end of the season? Or was he hired midway through the season?
One of those Mandela.
I don't.
Now.
No, I think it was at the end of the season they let him go. But
I think they
of the ones that got fired on Monday. Dan Quinn has been high. So that's it. No Vrabel, no Belichick, no Pete Carroll, if Pete Carroll even interviewed. Who else?
No, he's got that front office role.
He got that front office role he desperately wanted.
He wasn't fired. He was just reassigned.
So did you hear the story behind that, by the way? So here's what happened based on a couple of reports. So Carroll told the Seahawks towards the beginning of during the offseason that he was going to retire at the end of the 2023 season, right? So the organization went, okay, but they didn't want to make it a big deal. So they were working on plan B, which is where we're going to have a coaching change. But then at some point during the season, Carroll went to John Schneider and said, actually, I want to stay. And they said, it's kind of too late now. Like, we've now gotten accustomed to the idea of wanting a new head coach.
We've already made posters.
We've already sort of...
We have a new letterhead. We already hired a guy to come in and take your name off the door. And he can't reschedule.
It would be the equivalent of you and your wife deciding you want to move into a new house. And then you said to her, you know, I think we should just take the for sale sign off the thing. And she's like, no, too late. I've already saw five of them. I already like the floor plan in one. The neighborhood is great for the kids. Oh, no. There's a pool in the backyard. No, it's too late. Too late. Nope, you're selling the house. We're moving. They had an idea of, like, can you only imagine what they were saying behind his back? Like, hey, we're going to be able to change this. We're going to be able to change this. We're going to be like, hey. They already had it entrenched into them that there will be a new voice for this team. And he couldn't convince them. He thought, all right, they'll just say, stay. Okay, well, we'll just scratch all the plans. They went, we're gonna go with it. So that's one of the reasons they created the front office role. But he was kind of upset about it. Like, he thought if he just went back, hasn't this happened in sports before where players don't retire and teams go, could you just move on, please? Right?
Yeah, I feel like with more so with players than coaches.
With players, right? Like, I mean, I hate to bring it up because it actually did end on a kind of a positive note. But there was a period of time with the Yankees where they like didn't know what to do with Derek Jeter.
Yeah,
they were like, he can't bat second, right? Like he's not batting well. He's not like we don't know what to do. We've got this up and comer. We want to put him in there. We want to like and the same thing with the Steelers with Ben Roethlisberger, where you're just like, oh, no, I guess he wants to be bandaged up and put together like a Frankenstein robot and go out there and play football.
I guess in a way, I mean, definitely premature, but wouldn't that be with the Colts and Peyton Manning?
Sure.
You know, I mean, arguably one of the greats of all time. But
the neck injury, and they're like, we're not waiting around.
Chargers did it with Breeze.
Yeah.
I mean,
Belichick tried to do it with Brady.
Yeah.
Like, when are you getting the hell out of here?
Too much talk about you being the one who spearheaded everything, not me.
Wouldn't mind it if you retire now, Mr. 38. And then he goes, nah, I got a lot more years than that.
God. But then there was those like Brett Favre who kept trying to retire, but people kept coming back down and getting him. Like, I remember the story Jared Allen showed up to his house.
Oh, remember that? Yeah.
Pretty much kidnapped him. Said, no, you're coming back to Minnesota with me. Let's go.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So the Commander's job is done. You know what's funny is the Commander's job was treated as if Dan Snyder was still owning it.
Yeah.
Like, what was going on there? Like, people didn't want the Commander's job, or did they always have their laser beam on Dan Quinn?
We kind of talked about this yesterday, and you pointed this out again, and it just, you know, I sometimes forget it, but it just goes in my mind. Because I really sat there, I was like, you know, who doesn't, you know, I guess somebody doesn't want to be the head coach of this football team.
Right.
Is it such a bad organization that they don't want to be a head coach of the football team? And then you simply go, it's one of 32 jobs.
Right.
You mean to tell me they can't find one person who wants to do this job, be one of 32 people in the entire world that gets to do this?
Outside of being a president or leader of a country, like what other... Our CEO of something like this, you probably could find, there's not a lot of places where you're one of 32 in the world.
No, I mean, if you're a CEO, how many companies are out there?
Are like yours.
And then, you know, say, hey, let's just stick to, was it Forbes 500 or was it Forbes 100? I mean, you can narrow the list down. You can find more than $32 billion companies.
Right, exactly. They're the same thing. But there's only, at any given point, there's only 32 people that have NFL head coach underneath their letterhead.
Yeah.
Right. And that's it. And it, like, why wouldn't you take it? And for Dan Quinn, I mean, Dan Quinn, we can laugh all we want at 28-3, but he was the head coach of the Super Bowl participating Atlanta Falcons. Right? I mean, that's, you can do that.
And I love how it's being written down too. Commanders hiring Cowboys defensive coordinator.
Yeah. Yeah. Dan Quinn. That's awesome. That's great.
Taking one from a rival.
Yep.
I didn't think that was allowed.
So this might have been one of the reasons why you didn't hear a lot of buzz about Washington, was because they might have been just laser focused on a few guys like Ben Johnson, Dan Quinn, Mike McDonald, who are still actively participating in the fun and games of the postseason.
Weren't doing the Falcons thing where it's like, hey, let's talk to everybody.
Yeah, why don't we bring in 15 people for this head coaching job?
And then we'll talk to Marv down in human resources, see if he wants to do something.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So Dan Quinn, it's a pretty good hire.
No, I like it.
I do too. I like it.
I mean, I don't know what the appeal was for Dan Quinn, because then the Commanders like ship all their defensive players away.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. Well, you're hoping that that somehow this regime will give you some time.
Yeah.
And you can go, all right, I see what you did there. You got rid of some contracts of some players, but we do need to get some. We do need to start bringing them in. So. But, you know, it's funny that because when you look now, I mean, look, Dan Quinn was a former head coach, so he's like in the Raheem Morris category of coaches of this hiring cycle, right? So if you look at the coaches who have been hired, you've got three of them of the seven, if I'm counting right, that have had previous NFL head coaching experience, right? Dan Quinn now, Raheem Morris, and Jim Harbaugh. So then you've got first-time coaches that have been coordinators or coaches on staffs in Brian Callahan, Gerard Mayo, Dave Canales, Mike McDonald, and there's your seven. If I'm counting correctly, so three with previous NFL head coaching experience, four coordinators getting their first crack at this. Antonio Pierce, I forgot there was eight. Antonio Pierce has been hired. So he was an interim coach, but let's not necessarily count that. He was a coach on the staff of Josh McDaniels. He got to keep his job. He got to take the interim tag off, which kudos to the Raiders. I got to give credit to the Raiders. Sometimes I don't give them enough credit. That was great. Normally you don't do that. You put an interim tag on because it's really not the person that you want. And some people don't want the interim tag. Fans don't want the interim tag taken off. They want a brand new start with a brand new administration, if you will. But Dan Quinn has been hired as the Commanders coach, and now the coaching searches are done. All locked in as we head to the Super Bowl next week. We'll continue. It's Wake Up Call on Sports Map Radio.
This is Wake Up Call on the Sports Map Radio Network. Alongside Ron Culver, here's Tony D.
All right, once again, Throwback Thursday. This 2015, 14?
No, this one I believe is 2004.
2004, this would be the Patriots-Carolina Super Bowl on a Throwback Thursday. As the Pats win their second of six in Houston. They played two Super Bowls in Houston. And I can't remember, I think it was the second one that had the big Tom Brady jersey stolen scandal.
Yep.
That was the second one, right? Against the Atlanta Falcons.
Yep.
Where somebody stole his jersey. Yeah. They got the FBI involved in it and stuff. I was like,
well,
really?
Because it was international.
That's right. That's right.
It's a reporter out of Mexico.
Yeah. The reporter was in there and just took it. And then took it.
And then it was a fan who just happened to be buying it on eBay.
Yeah.
And didn't realize that he was part of a whole sting operation or ring or whatever. And he was the one who helped unravel the whole thing.
People watch too many movies where like the Mona Lisa is stolen from the Louvre and some collector and some island somewhere buys it has the real Mona Lisa.
I saw something stupid the other day. Like climate activists are, you know, listen, you know what? If you want to tell me that we need to change things about the planet, great. But, you know, sometimes with the way they're going about it, it's just plain dumb.
Oh, yeah.
You know, sitting down in the middle of a road, causing a traffic jam, which is causing more carbon emissions than, you know, before. But anyways, I saw a video the other day, and that's why you brought it up when you said Mona Lisa. Like, two people entered the Louvre and then threw, it wasn't paint, I want to say mustard, on the Mona Lisa.
Now, is the Mona Lisa, I've never been to the Louvre, is the Mona Lisa exposed where that hurt the paint? Isn't it there's glass in front of it?
Yeah, it's like, they literally went under the ropes. I mean, still there's ropes that you can't get right next to it, so there's ropes right there. And then they just go and they toss the mustard on there, and then they turn around and they just preach.
Ugh.
And I'm sure they were quickly moved. You hear a gasp from the audience, but then you hear like other people going, it's like, you know, there's like 17 feet of plexiglass.
Yeah, they're
going
to wipe that. They're just going to wipe that off.
Like, I feel, if you're going to feel bad about anything, feel bad about, you know, Joe the janitor over there who's going to now, it's like, he's got to scrub the mustard off.
He's got a spray bottle and a squeegee. he'll be removing all that nastiness.
Like, you know, somebody's going, like, sorry you did this. Ah, I had to do it last week too.
Yeah. So if you're going to buy like a Super Bowl jersey that's coming from a guy who stole it from a locker room, chances are they're tracking you down.
Yeah. No, yeah. But that guy didn't get in trouble. But the guy who's selling it on eBay.
He did. He got in trouble.
Idiot.
Yeah, stupid, selling it on eBay. Game-worn Brady jersey. The one they're looking for.
Yeah. He probably just grabbed it.
The one the FBI is investigating. Yeah. I have it right here.
I had a few grass stains. Did he even know who Tom Brady was?
Yeah, oh my goodness.
It's like, you know, the equivalent of, it'd be like an American stealing Messi's Argentina jersey.
And I hope if he was covering the Super Bowl, he would know who Brady was, but you never know.
He might not have been covering the Super Bowl. He might have just had a press credential so he could steal.
Do you think he got credentialed and became, was just a thief?
He had to. I mean, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, he definitely was credentialed because he was in the locker room.
Speaking of watches movies too much, that's my thought. You know, it's just a guy with a credential just stealing stuff.
Yeah, just went to go get some extra cash.
And whatnot. I did want to touch on this story. So I don't know what it is about Rory McIlroy. I want to switch to golf a little bit. Rory McIlroy seems to want this, like, he's kind of softened up on this live thing too much.
Well, okay, no, I'm glad you did switch to golf because I was going to talk about this partnership.
Yeah.
But it's not with Liv?
No, it's not. It's called Strategic Sports Group. So it's a bunch of billionaire team owners who have all chipped in to create what is going to be a $3 billion investment into the PGA Tour. So now it's going to make the PGA Tour, which was a non-profit entity, wink, wink, to a for-profit entity. And what their way they're structuring it is that the players on the PGA Tour are now going to get somewhat of an ownership stake in the tour. They're basically going to get shares in the company based on accomplishments and whatnot, so that they will have a lifelong financial gain from the growth of the PGA Tour. So what it's trying to do, at least the way I'm understanding it, is it's to incentivize a continual participation in the PGA Tour, because even though, life-changing money, I guess, over at Live that comes with a bunch of stipulations, this is just play on tour. You earn shares of this, and this is a revenue stream forever. You'll just have this for the rest of your life. You'll always have a stake in this. You'll always have an ownership stake in this that you could pass down to your kids, I'm assuming, like you own stock. And so Tiger Woods is big on it. He kind of, you know, thanked all of the participants of this, like John Henry and Steve Cohen and Arthur Blank. But Rory is kind of looking at it as, and I think Rory, I'll tell you where Rory's motivation is, at least from my perspective. Rory's kind of looking at it as, maybe we can all just come together and, you know, the Live guys and us, can we all just come together on this? Like, instead of, like, the PGA Tour obviously now has its own money. It doesn't need the Saudi group. And now there's a framework where PGA Tour players are going to be better off. Like, when I say better off financially, it sounds terrible. Like they were eating macaroni and cheese and hot dogs every single day, but it does put them in a good economic footing, like Liv is putting its players in good economic footing. But I think Rory's motivation is, if we continue to separate, I'm losing a lot of really essential teammates for future Ryder Cups that I care about a lot. The Ryder Cup is my thing. One day I'm going to be the captain of this. I'm going to continue to play in this. It matters to me as much as the majors. And I love the Ryder Cup. I get emotional at the Ryder Cup. And I just watched Jon Rahm and Tyrell Hatton, two instrumental players in our win in Rome, both of them jump into a new Live team. And I'm telling you, I'm losing my teammates by the week. It seems like these guys want to jump in on Live. young players are getting gobbled up by Liv. And I think he's looking at it from a European standpoint of, if we can soften the blow, meaning if there's a unification of Liv, DP World Tour, and PGA Tour, I can get my mates back. So that when we go to Bethpage in 2025, I will have the guys that are going or that should be on this team on the team. That's still a ways away, but I think that's one of the reasons why he's kind of softening up. Because Jordan Spieth, speaking at the player at this tournament in Pebble Beach, is kind of like, I think we're all right. Like, I think we're good. Like, I don't know if we need to merge with Liv. Like, this new thing is, it's our answer to what Liv has. It's our answer. Liv got the Saudi money. We kind of got this now. And so we didn't need the Saudi money. So, again, it's kind of weird. We touched on it a little bit yesterday. The biggest story of last year ended up being kind of nothing. It doesn't look like it doesn't look like a merger. It did, but now it doesn't look like it for the emergence of this strategic sports committee or group that is infusing the tour with a bunch of cash. But I got a question. How do you go from non-profit to profit without people thinking you were profit in the first place? Right? Like, what did you do?
I don't know, but as soon as you figure that out, the NCAA would like to know.
Would like to know, right? Yeah. Because they certainly loved it. The PGA Tour loved to promote it. It was a non-profit entity for tax reasons. But the moment they really needed to come through with, all right, we got to start changing the business model. And it's like, all right, it's for profit. We're just kidding. So who gets screwed?
It was for profit all along.
It was for profit all along. We just manipulated the numbers and gave a little bit more to charity, but the whole thing was for profit. Like, why did it have to be nonprofit? Like, the NFL's not nonprofit. Like, why didn't it just be like, we're a sports business, like any other sports business. We're trying to maximize the dollars. NFL's like, we made record-setting numbers. Major League Baseball does the same thing. By the way, did you see the Orioles got sold for less than $2 billion? And Cal Ripken is part of a group that's buying it? Cal Ripken and a couple of other people.
Yeah, I saw that.
Now, I gotta tell you, I'm not expecting the Orioles to be, they're not an NFL team, but you can get it for less than $2 billion? You get a Major League Baseball team for that?
Depending on the market, I guess. I guess Baltimore is really still small market.
I guess so, but it's still on that beautiful I-95 corridor.
Right.
You know, but it is territorial with Washington and Philadelphia, so I get that, but I wasn't putting it at like $4 billion or anything, but you know, 1.8 I think was what the Orioles sold for. It seems like, all right, that sounds like a bargain to somebody who does not have billions of dollars. Like if I had Facebook money or something, I'd be like, well, I could get a baseball team for $2 billion. Where do I sign me up for that? It seems a little cheap, but then again, it's the Orioles. Mm-hmm. They just got good. But nevertheless, it doesn't really matter. Your market size and your revenue and interest and all that. But still, nevertheless, look at us talking billions and billions of dollars. $3 billion on the tour, $2 billion for the Orioles.
Not a big deal.
Dan Quinn's got hired by the Commanders. Yeah, all of that. All right.
Chump change, really.
When we come back, more thoughts on this lawsuit Tennessee and Virginia have been filing. We'll continue with Wake Up Call on Sports Map Radio.
Wake Up Call with Tony D and Ron Culver continues now on the Sports Map Radio Network. Here's Tony D and Ron Culver.
Is this the 2008-2009 Super Bowl?
I think it's 2014.
2014. Oh, is this Lord? Yeah, it is. Yeah, you're right. This is Lord.
This is the one.
This is Royals.
Yeah, I always try to end with like an earwormy song, and this one kind of gets stuck in my head all the time because I could be royal.
This she wrote this seeing a picture of George Brett in a magazine. That's what the rumor is. I don't know if that's true.
Is it something Kansas City starting?
Why not? They start everything else.
Yeah.
cause me more rumors that I have to dispel than any other team.
So, I mean, are we in an uproar because Lord was shown on television Royals games a lot?
Yeah, I guess so. They invited her to the game. She did wear a Royals jersey. I remember seeing that.
And because of that, the Major League Baseball scripted. It's fixed.
Yeah, of course, it's rigged.
It's rigged.
This was a Super Bowl 49. Patriots over the Seahawks. By the way, real quick on these Throwback Thursdays, are you using the year of the season or the year the Super Bowl was
played? The year
played?
The Super Bowl played.
Okay, so this would be 2014?
Yeah.
No. When was this?
Well, the Super Bowl was played in 2014. I want to say it's the 2013 season.
Or was it the 14 season in the year 15? I don't know.
Yeah.
Whatever it is, Super Bowl
49.
It's on this date, 49.
In 2014, or we did 2009 and 2004.
It prevented the Seahawks from having a dynasty. The Seahawks could have had a dynasty. They could have been like, hey, this is one of the best teams in NFL. They've had their little run of like three Super Bowls in 4 years or something. But once this happened, once Malcolm Butler intercepted that pass, I think it all fell apart.
And then you saw my other suggestion for on this date in history.
No, which was that? It was, I do remember. No, I have to go back to it because I forgot.
It was 1984.
David Stern became the commissioner of basketball.
Yeah, and, you know, talked about him today, too.
He's my favorite commissioner of all the commissioners.
That's why I brought it up.
He's my favorite. I really liked David Stern a lot. The late, great David Stern.
And he held that thing. He was there for 20 years.
He was fantastic. He was the right commissioner for what the league wanted in the 80s, like when it was going through all of its problems and capitalized on the Bird Magic thing and then later the Jordan thing. But man.
You know what he did? I mean, he took the game and made it international. Expanded the brand of it. I mean, these players, when you consider like what Magic and Bird were probably making per year versus, I don't know, name your role player on any team right now.
Right.
Is ridiculous.
When was the last time you saw Rob Manfred, Adam Silver, Roger Goodell, or Gary Bettman have a press conference where they were seethingly mad? I can't remember.
I feel like Adam Silver had one recently.
He did. I feel like he did, but I.
But I don't think he was like he wasn't mad.
There
mad.
Were two press conferences David Stern had: Malice in the Palace and the Tim Donaghy stuff.
Yeah,
where he was ready to kill somebody in the room, like he just kept it. He's not going to go crazy. I'm going to start screaming. Not going to cuss. But you watched it. And went that guy is really angry. Really angry. And that's what I always liked about David Stern. Just straight up, I'm not playing around. We are not doing this. Like, he was really that. You get a lot of wishy-washy commissioners, you know. I mean, one that was in Major League Baseball was an owner, Bud Selig. I mean, when did Bud Selig ever get furious at anything? Except when you bring up Pete Rose. That was the only thing with Bud Selig we would get mad. He would kind of get testy at if you brought up Pete Rose. But you're right about Silver. There was a circumstance where Adam Silver was kind of mad. And I'm trying to remember what that was. But you're right. Silver was pretty upset about something. But he was really upset about the Donald Sterling situation. That happened on his watch. When Donald Sterling had to sell the team.
What was it?
But it was like, just recently.
It's like this season.
It was, it was just recently
was
that
it,
he was.
Was it, what's it, Draymond Green?
It might have been Draymond Green, but I don't know.
I don't feel like
really got under his skin as much as another issue in the NBA.
Or another issue with Draymond Green.
Yeah. I know they were pretty ticked off at Daryl Morey a year ago.
Yeah, but I feel like there was something else.
But Stern was, he had this just presence. I remember covering this, not covering him, but like cutting audio of it. And watching it, going, jeez. Malice in the Palace was the worst.
Yeah,
like the Tim Donaghy stuff, it went into his integrity. There was some leaked stuff about the Sacramento Kings and the LA Lakers championship. But Malice in the Palace, he had nothing. He wanted nothing to do with those guys. If it was up to him, he would have suspended them for the rest of their lives for doing that. And he couldn't because there was fight back from the union. But he was like, well, we're going to make this stick. We're absolutely going to make this stick. This is absolutely intolerable. Cannot have players punching fans. Even though the players were like, they're coming on the court. So it doesn't matter. Find your way off the court then. But yeah, David Stern becoming the commissioner of the NBA on this date in 1994. But listen, David Stern, at the center of my two sports conspiracies that I did buy for a long time. One I still have, the other one I don't. Still think he rigged the 85 draft. How he did it, frozen envelope, crease in the envelope, I don't care. Don't care. Don't want to know. I know David Stern reached into that thing, reached into that shell, whatever it was that ball of envelopes, and he pulled out the Knicks with the number one pick in the draft. I'll believe that till I die. The Jordan gambling thing, I gobbled that up like I was a conspiracy theorist on everything. I did. I hate to admit this, but I preached that to anybody that would listen. That Jordan was suspended, and that's why he went to baseball?
Or kind of like had to hide him away?
Yeah, so the theory went that Jordan, like, so Jordan's playing these games in, like, New York, and he's getting caught in Atlantic City. But then there were also these rumors that he was betting with a lot of bookies, like organized crime figures. So there was all these rumors that were floating around. And Stern needed it to stop, like, desperately. And so he sat down with Michael Jordan and said, you got two choices. This is the conspiracy, okay? This is what I believed. You got two choices. We can do the Pete Rose thing, or you just disappear for a little bit until this calms down, and then I'll let you come back, and you can play. And so there's all this evidence for it, right? Just out of nowhere, Michael Jordan says he's retired, and nobody knows why, and he had just won a championship, and he didn't have any problems with his team or his teammates. And then there was something about his conversation, his press conference, where he said, if they let me back, he implied that it was like a joke, like they were going to be like, well, there's no room for you here, Michael. You can't come back in the NBA. But people pointed to that piece and said, ah, see, he's serving a suspension without saying the word suspension. You have this global superstar. You can't suspend him. It's too scandalous. The league would get killed by it. But if you disappear and they'll give you a job with the baseball team, you want to play baseball, the owner will give you a gig. Reinsdorf will put you on his minor league baseball team.
Yeah, you won't have to start at the lowest of lows either.
You can go to the Birmingham Barons. And so I kind of gobbled that up for a while. And then I watched the 30 for 30. Jordan rides the bus, which is exactly what they'd want you to see if you bought into the conspiracy. But after a little bit more research, and the other thing was Sam Smith. I actually had a chance when I was doing overnights on this network. I talked to Sam Smith about that. And he said, not one thing of that conspiracy is true. The Bulls brand died. The NBA brand died. Like, it was a bad time.
Well, I mean, let me ask you a question. Would they have preempted Jordan in the NBA Finals against the Houston Rockets? Jordan versus Hakeem Olajuwon in the NBA Finals for the OJ police chase?
Not a chance.
The OJ police high-speed chase that it was?
Exactly. Exactly. So those were my two sports conspiracy. Of all the sports, the only two I bought had David Stern at the centerpiece of both of them. One of them I still have, but the other one, kind of lost its fun. I was young and silly. What can I say about that? I was young and I bought into it. It seemed to make sense. It made more sense to me than a guy leaving in his prime of his career to go play minor league baseball. I didn't care about the dad wanting him to play baseball. I was like, that's nonsense. That's all noise.
But you also kind of fed it into, like, you know, I always believed, like, the gambling part, because his father was murdered.
Oh, and yeah. Like, remember that rumor, yeah, too. Yeah.
The gambling part, the gambling issued in as well. I mean, yeah, they took out his dad to send a signal.
To send a message to him. But the other part of that story that made me kind of wake up to that nonsense was, like, I had to ask myself a question. What's more likely? That Michael Jordan served his time and then he got allowed to be back in the league, or, which is what really happened, the baseball players went on strike in 94.
Yep.
And then they asked him to be a scab player, basically, and he said, I can't. I'm a union guy too. It's not my union, but I'm a union guy too. I know what they're fighting for. I fight for it in my own sport. I can't do this anymore, and then decided, you know what? I've had fun. This was great. I'm going back to what I do the best, and that's much more likely than the conspiracy that I was dangling in. All right, it's Wake Up Call.